Fasten your seatbelts, everybody. Things are about to get poetic. Poetic peeps and gentle persons, in-betweeners and non-conformers, genders all and genders equal. Welcome to Eat the Storms, the poetry podcast. This is episode 2, season 8. I am Damien B. Donnelly, your host and producer, and thank you so much for joining us today. Whether that's on Spotify, Apple, Google, Breaker, Podbean, Player FM, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Castbox, Podcast Addicts, or iTunes. As usual on the show, we have four guests joining me to share their poems, their musings, their accents, and maybe even to introduce you to a new podcast to listen to or a new pamphlet to have on your bookshelf. And one of those guests will be joining me at the end of the show today for Behind the Storms, our new interview series examining the how, the why, and the what of poetry. The how we got into it, the why it captured us, and what we have done with it since. On today's episode, we have four guests, two from the United States and two from Ireland, one returning guest and three new guests to the podcast. And together we explore losses, mothers, husbands, ducks and directions. We'll hear from new collections, along with the shuffling of pages as aspiring collections come together. So for the next 70 minutes or so, I suggest you select all the sweet treats you can carry, settle yourself down on the sofa and let my guests take you away. My name is Damien B. Donnelly, this is Eat the Storms, a poetry podcast, and I hope you enjoy the show. For my first guest on the show today, we are heading to County Tipperary for a writer who is originally from Los Angeles in the United States and who is no stranger to podcasts, as she is now the host of A Thousand Shades of Green, her literary podcast, which literally just started its second season, and every episode sees the host read a selection of poems from one writer. A frequent guest here on Eat the Storms and also a two-time contributor to the Storms Journal, she is the author of Things My Mother Left Behind from Potter's Grove Press, and most recently, the Afrastic Collection in collaboration with Jane Cornwell called Tiger Lily. With work in places like Cronogue, California Quarterly, Ink, Sweat and Tears, and returning to join me at the end of today's show for our Behind the Storm series, it is my pleasure to welcome back to the show, reading from Things My Mother Left Behind, Susan Richardson.
Hi, Damien. Thank you so much for having me on Eat the Storms. It is an absolute pleasure to be a return guest on your beautiful podcast, which, as you know, I totally love. I am recording this just a couple of days before the end of 2023, and on January 2nd, it will be the 36th anniversary of my mom's death. So I thought today I would read a few poems about her. The first one, originally published in Anapest Journal, is called My Mother's Breaking Body. I yield to the call of the kitchen, a half-eaten dessert and the ache to feel full again. The nights have grown pallid in the grip of bereavement, my throat hollow, defeated. I lean against the dirty counter, shoving handfuls of tear-stained cake into my mouth, fingers heavy under the weight of despair. I stumble over images of my mother's breaking body, frail against the grain of hospital sheets that carry the scent of pain. The contours of the world are burned by the stench of cancer, laughter plucked out of the sky by the teeth of terminal illness. Her pleas for death have stained my thoughts. I fight to hold on to the echo of her fingertips, gently pushing back the escaping tendrils of my hair. Her touch dissolves into the pulse of a night that lives on, even though she has taken her last breath. Time escapes through fractures in the fabric of my identity. I find myself alone on the floor, gorging my emptiness on devil's food. The next two poems are from my book, Things My Mother Left Behind. This one is called Slipping Beneath Time. If I slip beneath time, race back to 17, will you stay with me, spreading poppies on the wind with your laugh, singing me awake on birthday mornings? If I smudge out history, pluck the weeds that death scattered between 20 and 30. Will you save me? Pull me from the bottom of a bottle, shatter it against the sky? If I step into the sun, turn willingly toward 50, will you see me? Youth pouring over my fingertips as the light is wiped from my eyes. So the last poem I've chosen to share today is called Address to Diane. When she was 40, she dressed in vintage clothes, patterns from the jazz age traversing over her shoulders. She'd go to the local pizza joint for a slice of pepperoni, sweeping through the door in a flourish of silk and velvet, ensconced in a feathered cloche, throat wrapped in emeralds. Grand entrances were her thing. At 48, when cancer thread itself into her breast and chemotherapy loomed at the door with teeth that threatened to break her, she scoffed and went shopping for what she called chemo clothes. She arrived for her first appointment, dazzling in a purple suede dress, adorned by costume jewelry with beads the size of plums, standing defiantly on platform heels, ready to fight for her life. In a hospital bed at 52, she scoured clothing catalogs given to her in secret by night shift nurses, and bought a dress to die in. It was the shade of a young peach, brushing light onto her cheeks, soothing and softening the scent of illness on her skin. She wore it the night of her final Christmas, laughing and beautiful, even as pain coursed through her body and her organs began to fail. It took 3 days for her to die, light fading into shallow breath, grief weaving itself like a bruise into the sun. Hours before she died, she lifted the oxygen mask from her face to breathe on her own for the very last time. She departed under a veil of defiance, pulling color from the sky, leaving the weight of sorrow to darken my bones.
My next guest on today's show keeps us here in Ireland. He's a poet, an academic, and a journalist, a Best of the Net nominee who's been published in over 100 journals in more than 20 countries, and currently he has two collections to his name. The first is his debut collection, Flowers, All Sorts in Blossom, published by Dreek in 2020. And most recently, Baraboo published his second collection, Lilies on the Deathbed of a Time, from which we'll read selections today. His work has appeared in places like About Place, The Door Is Ajar, Books Ireland, Reservoir Road and Northern Gravy. Today, as a first-time guest to Eat the Storms, I'm very pleased to hand you over to Oisin Breen.
Hello. So the first thing I want to do is to thank Damien for having me on the podcast. He does great work with it, and it's a pleasure to be here. I suppose I should also say thanks very much for listening. I'm going to read to you two pieces from my latest collection, Lilies on the Death Bed of Time, which is available through Downingfield. So if you do find yourself in the mood, please pick up a copy and let me know what you think. The two pieces I'm going to read, the first is literally just called Five. It's the fifth section of the headline poem, which is a long-form piece called Lilies on the Death Bed of Time, which is a pretty epic piece. The second is called At Swim Two Pair, and it's essentially, long story short, the story of traumatized ducks. The story of literally how many duck deaths there are per brood of duck, and just thinking about the actual tragedy of it and trying to put a new spin on something we see all the time but don't always notice. So my thanks, and without further ado, here's the poetry. Five. Yet I am, I was, I will be, and I will not be. The same is true for you. We are born and we die. And she is, she was, she will be, and she will not be. And this is as true for our mothers as it is for our fathers. Everyone we love must die. Know then that grief enacts its pallor on us relentlessly. Death is a snare, we the trapped hair, senses in lieu of limbs, bared like torn muscle and steel jaw traps, suffering under a merciless gloaming of the soul that racks even the flesh of children at play. They in pirouettes, those shadowed dancers in the dusk of harvest time, realizing in one long day they'll race each other's heartbeats to a standstill, pull flecks of hay from each other's temples, laughing, and then one of each pair will fatten with the weight of another marked utterance of life wrought onto being, for they, like us, perish. Watch the fires burn and the trap snap shut, senses in lieu of limbs racked with fulsome distemper, with each mile fled marked by a funereal stone. But one marker is harder to traverse than the rest, because when your mother dies, the tether snaps, and you know something is gone that will never return. But in loss, there is also the renaissance of stillness. One heartbeat in which to live. One vision, one mind, and a coalescence, our footsteps illumined by what we may yet become. So with one heartbeat, one steady moment of exultant pleasure, in rapture, I am become the sum of my parts, and beyond that, the end anew to end. And I traipse idly with the same pitter-patter mind as the marsh tits that scavenge for scraps at the top of Leith Walk, rambling down Broughton Street, neath Claremont Street and St. Mark's Path, over the water, thinking of the great stone bridge, and where you drink the waters to stave off the side, death schlepping myself down Warriston Road, accompanied by the sound of screeching gulls, and here, by Crowbridge, her red shoes and frame of purple stone, guarding the twilight, I like to walk. It is peaceful, after all, here among the dead. For those who come to mourn show their rent hearts in their openmost in sight, and here, I once saw the face of God. Here, Alilangabe, brother of Yochlarim, split himself into sherds to leave a portion of himself always watching over their mother, she who died of grief and memory, lost after the burning of her second son. Here, Alil stands vigil too, and once, when I went to the crematorium, I saw him, God struck, and his was the face of God, and that lamenting voice his too, that song of skin sung to the pilgrim's heady melody. He was laughing, telling stories about her, and he couldn't stop smiling. And then the curtain fell, the committal. Then he fell. He snapped. He, a twig under the hunter's boot. He, a reed torn by a careless child. He, later gathered by a mother duck to build a nest. He, bereft of she beyond forgetting. She who had through illness long since forgotten him. She whose love was without end until it was pregnant with ending and imbued of ash. So with one heartbeat, one steady moment of exultant pleasure, in rapture, I am become the sum of stars, and beyond it, the end anew to end. And he fell, motherless. Motherless, he fell, and I have never seen anything so beautiful. At Swim Two Pair. In two directions then they swim, mother, sister, and kin, their bodies half submerged in the gloaming, vespers sung, and the water around them weaves eddies, a nest of spent influences and serried trails, shivering outwards in concentric circles, a plush map of hydrogen and oxygen blended in a platform for ambitions that span millennia, for designs we also dearly hold as passing seconds, marked by respiration and measured in calls, calls that begin near the heart as syrinxes swell. And those calls are an act of flutistry too, before the breaking branch of breath as folds of flesh vibrate and waves of sound overlap parallel to the current shift through a tiny box of cartilage scaled in millimeters, a bone memory and a fuselage formed of libretto shared with each an issuance of courting rolled out in sets of 2 and 10, each pair softer than the last, each met equally by a distribution of rasping two-note calls and shrill whistles which warn and shepherd too, yet unfashioned for song, these calls instead prove spirit-shaping sounds, a known quantity of convocated speech, the quail of river birds, and they swim together, mother, sister, and kin, 4 abreast for weeks longer than they ought, 2 generations keening in motion, 2 pair will once move to 64. Yet for 20 days the youngest 2 dozen of the brood, it larger then, sheltered their water-wet crowns under a pair of common roofs, hewed out of protein and hollowed bone. They sheltered under outstretched fibres of pleated skin, megahanum old, and in form a living shadow guise, an echo of frilled throats slung back to scream a lustrous piercing note, a step function for the beating of the heart, and a last reminder of how silence shares the significance of loss, even with those glutted, flesh-fat bellies of the always death near hunting birds and the long wearing down of polyphyodont teeth. Yet for 20 days the work of time became a meshwork of rest, of webbing spread and hind legs in haste pushed back and down, steadily pressing against the water in a silent rapture of movement as 2 broods grouped, lingered along lock foil, and when the first day was done it became too a tableau of soft sound as the youngest swiftly learned to forage, run and swim, a lesson long a prelude for the water thirst of 24 as each saw in the charred blemishes 5 years had left, time's trace on their mother's face, a compulsion likely a decade long to push bodies below the waterline to meet an ocean deep need to drink gallons each alone by the day. And they swim together now, mother, sister, and kin, 4 abreast for weeks longer than they ought, 2 pair keening in motion, yet their damp rustling is but a bleary epilogue of talons hooking flesh of hawk and owl and gull, of otter, mink, stoat, each eager to strike, each eager to satiate a hunger known even below by the dappled pike, their burrowed maw of water song and its whirlpool gulps were last brood blow, survived only by the 4 strong testament it left behind. 2 pair in motion were once moved to 64.
And we're staying in Ireland now for a third guest, but this time we are heading to County Clare over on the West Coast for another first-time guest to Ease the Storms. This time it's a singer-songwriter and a poet who's had a love affair with words and songs since her early years in the local Gael school. However, it wasn't until 2017 and the loss of her husband that her writing practices became more personal. As you're going to hear today, with her heart on her sleeve, her work deals with a weight of grief and a way of accepting and incorporating that grief into the journey. It's an honour to welcome to Eat the Storms for the first, but not the last time, Amanda Jane Shannon.
Hello, Damien Achara. How are you doing? Thank you so much for having me on your amazing podcast. Thank you for allowing people like me to have the space to share with the world what we sometimes hide inside in the deep darkness of the winter. And I'm really excited to read some of my poetry for you and for others. And I feel like it would be remiss not to share, I suppose, that a lot of my poetry is hugely influenced by the loss of my husband in 2017 to esophageal cancer. And I suppose it's been my work to unravel And I've done that through poetry and somehow tried to make sense of this friend grief who hangs around me a little bit. And of course, it's not the only thing I write about, but it sometimes has a way of taking room. And I've been learning through poetry that that's not such a bad thing. So yeah, I hope that without further ado, people will find some insight or some beauty in what has been a strange and sometimes lonely walk. So I think that the first piece I will read, first of all, is Raging Seas. And it was inspired by those first mornings alone as I would drive up to Connemara to teach. And I would always take that moment for myself in the wildness of Furbo. Raging Seas. Elemental alchemy, as wind and sea meet, both raging and swirling around my tired limbs, icy fingers gripping my ankles, shoulders pulled back, wailing, forcing my attention elsewhere, breath out of step and heart out of rhyme. For a moment, we all freeze. Eyes shut, drawing myself back to my internal room, sand losing shape beneath me, feeling a fall, arms out, seeking the wild and angry wind lest she feel rejected. She whips behind me. Suddenly I am steady again. My eyes peer so slowly at my feet, lost in the icy waters. Screaming wet gales upon my cheeks, my hair, my tornado crown, wild, free, and inconstant. Furbo, my medicine walk, my wild sister, my secret. It's so hard not to imagine those walks, actually, once I read it back again. Thank you. I hope you get a little bit of a visual. I think the next piece that I will read is Warrior Most Wanted. It's a new piece and it's based on a horrible dream. But like all things with this walk, I've chosen to take beauty from the hardness of some of the experiences. So I hope you enjoy Warrior Most Wanted. No mattress beneath the backless robe. Only that steel icy slab. One clenched fist, heeding the searing pain, holding the sacked cavern. Hot, hellish, unforgivable, unforgettable, unknowable, unsure. In this horror, these heavens, haunting and halo-free. An angel in a flat line, begging, beseeching, beginning again in a new manner, free hand reaching, the old hysteria hanging from my ankles, you, my Achilles heel, my Ares, warrior most wanted by Adonai. And one of my favorite pieces that I've written, in for me anyway, it's my one of my favorites. And I think it's where grief and I started to understand we are like friends, and I see her as a companion. And of course, grief is not something you want anyone to go through, but it's something we can avoid. And so for me, this piece has given me back some sense of hope and normality and beauty. The friend. Even death had her gifts, although I didn't want to receive them. She kept keening away, clawing at my chest, until there was a wave that broke apart the rock that had formed there. She made a beautiful coastline for me to sit and admire, gifting me sunrises, sunsets, pebbles, shells, and a few messages too. She persisted to write handwritten notes in bottles. With gasps, I receive them on the sandy shores still, stillness as they land. Death, she weaves a beautiful calligraphy, words with weight, delicate and beautiful. It's a dance now, her and I, in an embrace. Sometimes wild winds whipping at my ankles, other nights moonbeams shining on my cheeks. Would I trade, she asks, old ways for new wisdoms? I look her in her steely eyes, the answer in my belly. No words. No words. Moonlight always wins my heart. Thank you. Thank you for listening. And I'm going to finish with one piece called Cailleach, which is like the hag or the old lady. And I love this piece too. Cailleach, bended knee, in prayer, venerating her wildness and suffering, keens she for the soft, wet grass each morning. Cailleach, sacred womb, warm, commanding her secrets, her golden sageness settling down to the grey smoke of the hearth. Cailleach, still sitting, her hustling hands blanketing pearls born from wild chase, winter waxing the dampness in her bones in this dust. Cailleach, with her own crown of silver, sapphire eyes remarkable, pristine and sharp, silky love in her hips, as she, loyal to her spirit, murmurs her daily devotions. Cailleach, her front body revealed to the hearthstone, fire snapping, the fire fae frolicking and gleaming, fondled by the word, head to toe, eyes crease as a smile breaks free, for Cailleach is me. Thank you for listening.
Before Susan Richardson returns to join me again for Behind the Storms, our new interview series, it's time to welcome our final guest to the show today. And this guest takes us all the way to the United States, where he was born in Washington, D.C. and then grew up in Florida. Another first-timer to Eat the Storms, he is the author of Psalms of the Street Sweeper, from which you're going to hear poems today, and Tourist Trap. And aside from all of that, he's also the editor-in-chief of Skyway Journal. With a bachelor's degree from the University of South Florida in Tampa and a love of beach, tacos, baseball and all things crime, settle back now in the company of Fred Shrum.
Good evening, everyone. This is Fred Shrum III coming from Florida, USA, and I am of Irish descent. And I want to say it is an honor to be on the podcast. Thank you, Damien, so much for including me with these wonderful poets on Eat the Storms. All of these poems are coming from my new collection, Psalms of the Street Sweeper, which came out in July of 2023. This first poem is called Folsom Flatline. It is a collaboration with Will Davis. I have had my fill tonight in the castanet rattle of pills, the landscapes made small in plastic cups on a bedside table, the metered allowance of vials and tubing winding along the pale extension of my arm. I was a made man, heart so hard. Now I'm shriveled, skin is paper thin. I know I'm bad, but I don't deserve to die like this. Midnight in a prison hospice ward, only the nurse to cry for me. This is called Greed is Good. Greed is good, but dominance is better. I sign the back of checks and merger letters. Don't mess with my profit and nobody gets hurt. I drink champagne with Lily and bump lines with Bert. I've got the city over my knee. It only took ambition. Get out of your cardboard box and join the revolution. It's all legit. I make more in one day than a Dillinger robbery. Tax code has my back. Legitimate business expenses are coded properly. The law is on my side because I donated politically. Learjet on the tarmac takes me where I want to be. This is called Good to the Last Drop. The bottom of the bottle makes its way into my stomach. Liquid gold ignites my nerves like flame. I think I made a mistake again, but I don't know when. I don't know what day it is. I someone up the driveway Christmas Eve, somewhere between late and early. What have you done? She screamed. What have you done? This is called Slug City. Las Vegas is the city that never sleeps. As I drive down the strip, everybody beeps. The cash washes in and out like waves, flash a smile and be on the front page. Here is where the sand turns into gold. Make a wrong move and turn your blood cold. Make your dreams for pennies on the dollar. So many feelings for sale, even a wise man could falter. The king stopped for a red light in his BMW. Just another night of being on top. The Cadillac pulled up beside him. Four shots rang out. Just like Selden, his body dropped. Take the white pill. Dad was passed out on the recliner again. I wipe the drool from his chin and check it for foam, then cover him with a blanket. I spied the bottle on the counter. It wasn't his name. A desperate shame spiral started with medical advice. He was a CPA. Now he does deals in the parking lot. Life changed irrevocably because a car smashed his spine. I'm only 9 years old, but I know this is wrong. Dad sweats and shakes while the doctor goes on another cruise. The big grapple. New York City, gleaming towers, birthplace of dreams, no place for cowards. Familia Irazicas, this is my place to be. A fortune on every corner. How far I go is up to me. Now the entire city is shut down, doors locked and windows barricaded. The jobs have dissipated, a future lost overnight. Empires crumble into the dirt on your face. A tear cuts the path that I kiss away. If I can hold you tonight, everything will be okay. This is called Not a Gateway Drug. We used to sit on the curb and smoke cigarettes, have a long hair growing contest. Talk about our friend Nick and how he's been circling the drain lately. He just can't seem to get his shit together. He's taken the green haze to the next level. You even said the song What Happened to You by The Offspring should be dedicated to him. Now, the nights have turned cool. Your hair is getting long. You've missed a lot of work lately, and I don't know what to do. Wolf and White Van. Who's that parked near the school bus stop? Muddy license plate with the windows blacked out. Who's that cruising the mall parking lot near the toy store with a speaker pointing out? I approached him that day, one door down from my house. What are you doing here, man? I'm just picking flowers. The TPD says they have no PC. The tag is clean, and there's nothing wrong with a leisurely drive. I think I remember him now. I must have seen his face on a flyer from Ohio. This is called Tourette's. They keep their son on the back balcony so he wouldn't disturb others, but we heard him every afternoon as we walk by. Some days he likes seagulls. Other days he heeds pigeons. Or he got a haircut after he kicks Santa Claus's ass. But all I could think was, did he want a hug? This is called Change the World. When I was born, they threw me in a piss pile. I dealt with it and said, this is only for a while. I crawled out using nothing but my wits. Got beat down with pile drivers, but I didn't use my fists. I sharpened my teeth with the words of the masters, ignored all the doubters, and honed my skills faster. I can lead the nation with a microphone. I can change their hearts with my words. Just a simple touch that conveys so much. It's the way that I speak that makes them dream. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate your time. I hope you all have a great, wonderful day.
And now perhaps you want to take a moment to grab another cup of tea or fill up the glass of red wine. It's time to chat. On today's episode of Eat the Storms, as part of our Behind the Storms interview series, I am delighted to be joined by Susan Richardson, who you heard earlier on this episode. Susan, as I said, is the author of the collections The Things My Mother Left Behind from Potter's Grove Press, and most recently, a collaborative collection with visual artist Jane Cornwall called Tiger Lily. She is also the blogger at Stories from the Edge of Blindness, and last year she began her own literary podcast called A Thousand Shades of Green, currently available on Spotify, but more about that later. Susan, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
We're now both podcast people.
I know.
It's growing. It's spreading. It's spreading like poetry. It's interesting because, you know, I started during COVID because it was the only way to really connect. But it's wonderful to see you now starting the same thing in a completely different format.
Yeah, thank you. And I really am grateful to you. I really do owe the idea to you because listening to you gave it to me. And I also love the idea of offering poetry to people who may not turn to it, you know. Yeah. Like I have a lot of friends and they're like, yeah, poetry, I don't read it, you know. And it's not, maybe once upon a time poetry was just for poets, but I don't think it is anymore. I think it's so much more accessible, and sometimes when you hear it, the accessibility becomes even greater, you know. It changes, and I love that. And obviously I love poetry. You love poetry. Yeah.
I think it's interesting what you said in terms of like people being afraid to read it. And I think that is what podcasts are now doing, that there's a fear of picking up a book and not being able to figure it out. But when you have either the author or like yourself reading a poem for you, that audio experience becomes something completely different, I think. Yeah. It takes it to a whole different level. There's less fear for the listener. Maybe just to let people know, so A Thousand Shades of Green, your new podcast, it's now in season two. Might be a little weird for us to talk about things in advance, but it's currently Wednesday afternoon on the 24th of January, but this episode is not going out until the 10th of February, which means that your second season will have already started. What you do extraordinarily well on your podcast is that you ask poets, can you read their poetry? So it gives a whole new twist on the poetic voice suddenly being interpreted by another poet rather than that of the author. You had a fantastic lineup in season one. You had Stephen Denehan, Lawrence Murr, Suzanne Craig-Whitehawk, Samantha Tyrrell, and of course, our dear friend, as we already mentioned, Anique Yerram. And I got to be a part of it as well. Huge thank you for that. How long does it take you to figure out how to read a poem and to attach yourself to a poem of someone else's?
You know, it's so far, I have the luxury of choosing the people that are on the show. So the first season was writers that I love. So it's work that I already feel an affinity to. And that makes it easier to read, but it's a lot of practice. And it's many, many takes. I don't just sit down and like, hey, let's go. I want it to be good for the writer. I don't want to disappoint them. I want, you know, and I'm not, you know, by nature a performer. So, you know, it's a new thing for me. But I love it. Some people use language in a way that is just meant to be read aloud. It's gorgeous, you know. And sometimes I'll read people's books and I read them out loud to myself because they need to be read aloud. And so much poetry is like that.
Well, I think it's almost like what you've said there. It's almost like I love musical theatre, and I know people have this thing about musical theatre, but oh my God, like, do they have to just burst out into a song at a certain
Yes, they
point?
do.
But I think it's like poetry sometimes, it's too big to be held just on the page, It has to burst out, it has to rise beyond just the ink. And yeah, that's what you're touching on. That's what you're doing so incredibly well. Thank you
Thank
so much
you.
for having me on. And I know that you and your first guest, actually, for season two, was my first guest on the podcast ever, Gaynor Kane from Belfast.
And that's how I know Gaynor's work because of you.
Here's the communities. There's so much talk, I think, sometimes about, places like Twitter or Facebook, being negative places. But I have to say, the community that I've met and discovered since COVID and after COVID has been, I feel privileged.
Me too. Me absolutely. My experience has been really positive. I'm sort of by nature kind of a shut-in, but I mean, places like Twitter and also for me, WordPress, because I write a blog, really gave me a community and introduced me to other writers and new writing, and it's been really positive.
I imagine you needed that. So just maybe to explain, you're joining us now from down in Tipperary here in Ireland, where you moved with your husband Joe during COVID. But of course, you're not originally from there. You're originally from the United States, LA in particular. So I suppose it was important then to find a community when you did move here. But I suppose the point of these interview series is to go back to the beginning and figure out, why poetry. So I wonder if I can ask you how poetry has made its way into your life. What was a young girl's introduction to poetry like in the United States when you were growing up?
I honestly was never much of a student. I wasn't big on school. I went, but it was about socializing. But I was always a big reader. And I started out as a kid just writing stories. And I tell this story, and this is not about poetry, but just about writing in general, that I feel this is when I became a writer. I was about 6 years old, and we had to write stories for American Thanksgiving. And kids were writing stories about, big dinners and, the pilgrims and whatever. And I wrote a story called The Sad Turkey about a turkey who walks into the middle of the road in front of a car and commit suicide because he would rather take his own life than be killed by some nasty farmer. I was six.
Wow, you were six.
I was six,
Wow, you were definitely a writer at six.
So my teacher thought this is so disturbing, and my mom just was like, "Oh, you're very creative." But I think, I mean, it's kind of dark for a 6-year-old to write about that, but I always say that my mind worked differently. And I tried to do other things. I mean, believe it or not, I started university. I didn't finish, but when I started, I was going to be an actor. And because I had done a little bit of acting, because I got to disappear, right? It didn't have to be me. So me standing up in front of people and talking is terrifying. But being some character is a completely different deal, right? But then I took a playwriting class and I wrote a one-act play. And my acting teacher was also the teacher for this class. And she said, you need to be writing. I don't know what you're doing with this acting. I was not a good actor. But poetry, when I was in high school, like many other people, I discovered Sylvia Plath. And I think Sylvia Plath is brilliant. And through her, I learned what language can do, right? It wasn't just about reading a great story, because I read many great stories. I was always a reader. But it was about using language to create images and feelings. And it became about the language. And that's when I really, really started writing. Not poetry specifically. I mean, this is crazy. It's like a negative positive story, but like I said, I was not really big in school. I just wasn't my thing. But I was taking an English class. I was 11th grade, which is like 16, 17.
Yeah.
And we had to write a journal. And instead of writing what the teacher told us to write, I just wrote what I wanted to. And I turned it in, and he gave it back to me, and his comments were inappropriate, but he said, if you really wrote this, it's good. Basically saying, you can't possibly have written this because you're a terrible student. But it was like, okay, you know, he wasn't happy I didn't follow his rules, but in a way it was like, all right, I'm following this, you know, sort of passion. And then I stopped writing for a long time. You know, life happens. You know, your path veers all over the place. Mm-hmm. And in my early 20s, I was writing a lot. I was submitting, I was getting published. And then in 2015, I really started writing again and writing poetry again, because I had been blogging for a few years. And then I started to get published a little, and I started to write more, and I sort of, the passion for it got reinvigorated, and I really do love it, right? It's not this, I want to tell people all the time, poetry is not this stale, boring thing, you know, it's exciting, and language is so powerful. I guess it means everything to me, you know, it's such an incredibly beautiful thing, and poetry is artwork.
I was reading Tiger Lily again this morning, and I think perhaps that's why your words and Jane's visions work so perfectly together, because you both have a passion for what you do, but in each there is either a story or a visual. Like Jane draws, paints, sketches, but there's a tale in it, and you can tell it quite clearly. You write, but there are visions, there are images in what you write about. So, you know, the collaboration of the two of you together is, you know, mind-blowing. It's sort of perfection to a degree. You know, you don't know which came first. You know, they both seem to have arrived together.
Thank you so much. That's very cool. That's very nice. And I love working with her. You know, and that Tiger Lily was it's very cool, because some of the poems came first,
mm-hmm,
and
yeah.
Some of the drawings came first, and then things changed. Like there's a poem in Tiger Lily called Love Song.
Yeah.
And I wrote that poem based on this really simple kind of black and white drawing. And then Jane took it and painted what's in the book. I mean, she really took what I wrote, and, you know, because it's a little bit of a morbid picture, but then it's not. She took it and brought this sort of like life to it. It's like, that's what I was trying to say.
But it's also an extraordinary, that's a brilliant choice, because it's life to it. And hopefully our listeners will purchase a copy of Tiger Lily, but you know, it's called Love Song. The title is already, you know, it puts you on a different track of thought when you open the page and you see Love Song, and then you read it, and perhaps you've seen the accompanying painting from Jane, but it's beautiful, and you do see it is a love song between the earth and the boy, and sort of that gentle snap and fall at the end. We won't give too much away, but it is morbid, but there's a beauty to it. And it was Paul, just to bring people back a little bit, so the year prior to that, Paul Brooks of the Wombwell Rainbow, he was doing his annual Ephrastic Challenge, and you took part in that. And is that how you first came in contact with Jane's artwork?
That's how I met Jane. That's my sort of when I really first delved into doing ephrastic work, which I think is a blast. I love, right, the idea of artists of, you know, collaborating like that, right? And how we all inspire each other so much, you know, like why not get inspired wherever you can? And for me, I don't try to be like exact with it, right? I don't look at it and say, okay, here's this thing, I'm going to write about it. So I'll look at a painting or drawing, it's going to evoke a feeling in me, and mm-hmm. that's what I that's what I write.
It's interesting because, so you have two collections now. The first one, as I said, from Potter's Grove Press, The Things My Mother Left Behind, and then followed on by Tiger Lily. Both of them, to a degree, I would say, share some common themes that run through them at times. But yeah. I imagine both of them completely different experiences because, one, you're writing completely on your own and it's your first time coming out. But the second one, you get to collaborate with somebody else.
Yeah.
How was that second outing then in comparison? Was there a comfort in writing and creating and putting a collection together with someone else that sort of wasn't there maybe at the beginning?
You know, I think it has to be the right person. Yeah. You know, it's obviously when you're creating any kind of art, it is such a personal thing. And for me, there couldn't have been a better person than Jane. She is just a warm and gracious, generous, loving person. And I love her art. I mean, she inspires me every minute. And I knew it, right? I knew she was the right person for mm-hmm. me to work with. And it's sort of, you know, when you're writing and it's completely solo, it's rewarding, but as you know, it can also be painful and exhausting, and you're sort of sitting with your ghosts all the time.
Yeah.
And I think to be able to have, you know, sort of this dialogue with somebody and, you know, also be able to step away from your work a little bit, mm-hmm. give to mm-hmm. them for a little while. I mean, it's kind of this beautiful conversation, you know, that yeah. you get to have, this ongoing conversation you get to have with another artist. And it was beautiful. And I would do it again in a minute.
The Things My Mother Left Behind, in terms of the two, as I said, each of them share sort of these exposures to loss. Your father appearing in Tiger Lily in the beautiful title poem, as we said, Love Song. And of course, you know, your mother appears again in Tiger Lily. And then there's also, as I was noticing, there's a lot of references to eyes, to sight, to vision. Yeah. It reoccurs throughout the poems. But also there's this sense of mythical, ethereal, even the shadows are very sensual in Tiger Lily. Whereas I suppose The Things My Mother Left Behind, I don't want to say less sensual, but it's definitely much more personal. You know, you didn't have that ability to sort of, as you said, step away and let Jane do a painting in between. So you're dealing with the loss of your mother. As you said earlier in the podcast, it's now 36 years since her passing. And then also the journey, your own journey, which is part of your blog as well, your own journey into loss of your vision. How was that to journey alone? As you said, you know, you were writing this yourself. How was that to put together? Was it cathartic, therapeutic?
You know, I think it was definitely cathartic and therapeutic. And I think this is clear from the book. It's an angrier book. I had lost my dad not long before it came out. And there was a lot of stuff in there too I felt like I needed to write, which my next collection is also something that I need to write.
Yeah.
That I've started working on. Things My Mother Left Behind, honestly, it was painful. It was a painful journey, but it was a necessary one.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like there was a lot of growth in writing the poems in that book. You know, I don't want to romanticize that. I can't, right? It was hard. It was, I think at times with my writing, I can be sometimes brutally honest. And I need to be. That is what happens mm-hmm. when I write. You know, like I've had people question, you know, should you be writing so much dark stuff? And you've read my work, you know, I lean in that direction. But that's what I do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've learned over the years, the most important thing is to be true to your own artistic voice.
And there's also this extraordinary craft that comes from trying to build something in the darkness.
Yeah.
To relate what it's like to be in the dark. And in order to do that, you have to remember what the light was like.
You do.
Which in the darkness, that can be a painful thing. You know, you come out of a cave and suddenly you're blinded by the light, you know.
Right. And they need each other.
Yeah.
I think that is a vital thing, and hopefully a theme that probably will always run through my work. You know, I have an acupuncturist, and I love her. She's a healer. She's amazing. And she reminded me of that sometime in the last 6 months, you know, and I gave her a copy of my book, and she was like, the darkness and the light, they need each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they do, right? And I think if we don't face our own darkness, then we may not be able to take in the light. In this sort of like full and magical way. You know, I think both things are important. And I mm-hmm. spent a lot of my life, you know, feeling afraid of, I think, things that were dark, and feeling afraid of making other people uncomfortable. I mean, it's not like I don't want people to feel that, but I need to be true to what's happening. And you know what? My loss, someone else has felt that loss.
Exactly. And you need to be able to grow into who you are in order to figure out who to express who you are.
Yeah.
So that exactly like you say, somebody else can read it and go, oh, thank you so much. You know, I want to see myself in the lines of a page so I know I'm not alone.
Yeah, right. I mean, isn't that a huge part of what we do, right?
Well, like, you know, as a gay man growing up, you know, and like trying to find a book in the end of the 80s, the beginning of the 90s, you know, trying to find any book where I was visible at all. I remember I was about 17 and I found one book, and you know, maybe there were more, but that was the length of time I wanted to go in that kind of like tiny little section of the bookstore that were, you know, other, you know, books for others, and bringing it home. And it was at Christmas, and like I sort of spent like 2 weeks under the Christmas tree like reading it, and it was like a jewel, you know. But and at that time I hadn't told anyone I was gay, so it was my secret, and this was suddenly my book and I was in it.
Oh my god.
But like, these are rare things. And you know, I was at a reading of Sean Hewitt recently, and when he finished, I just said to him, like, thank you for writing books where we're visible, you know. And this is the thing, this is what we need. This is what we need to be able to celebrate ourselves in pages.
Yeah.
And share the stories.
I think people then find themselves in it, but also discover new things, like maybe learn things that they wouldn't have even thought about before. I started writing my blog initially because I wasn't writing, and Joe actually said, why don't you try and write a blog just to get yourself going? I'm like, okay. And initially it was just going to be about my sight loss. But during the process, it's become about more than that. I think people had such an idea in their heads about what blindness meant, right? That if somebody was blind, they just couldn't see anything.
Yeah.
And it was nice to feel like I could say, hey, you know, I consider myself blind, but it means lots of different things. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm looking at you, I can see you, but if you were sitting next to me, I mean, I've got almost no peripheral vision. So that's the deal. That's so I have retinitis pigmentosa, and basically I'm losing my vision from the outside in. So I don't drive. I don't even push a shopping cart. Joe does all that because I've run into people. And I'm frequently, you know, bruised and banged up because I bump into things.
And is it slowly progressive, or how is that?
It's very slow. So for me, I am really lucky because my vision has been stable for probably 12 years.
Okay.
So the last specialist that I saw, he said it may never get any worse than it is. So I have probably, I don't know, maybe 15% of my peripheral vision.
Okay.
But I can still, you know, I can still read.
You can still write frantic poetry and be inspired by fantastic art. Like,
yeah. I've also learned a lot about myself and a lot about, you know, eyes and vision and all that stuff that I never would have learned. And it also has given me a lot to write about. There is a lot in my first book about it because it, you know, it profoundly affects my life. That's what we do, right? We write about.
We do. I was wondering, because now you're thinking about, talking about the things that profoundly affect us, you moved to Ireland for the first time without ever having been here to County Tipperary during COVID in lockdown. So therefore, even when you got here, you couldn't move very far. And I was wondering, has your writing changed because of that? Has it changed because of being in Ireland, because of the landscape, because of the weather? Tipperary is not necessarily Los Angeles.
So it's a little bit different. you know, a good portion of Tiger Lily, actually, I wrote here, or definitely worked on it. I edit like crazy. And I feel sorry for any publisher who works with me, because I'm just, you know, I'll get proofs and I'm like, oh no, oh God, that has to be changed, you know? So I don't know, you know, I think it's going to be curious for me as I really sort of delve into this next book, how it feels, if I notice a change in my writing, since living here, like, yeah. Or how it's inspired me. In terms of my writing, I think there are things still in my past that I need to explore. Some things you are inspired to write, you see something beautiful, you're in a place, you get a feeling, right? A line comes to you, a word comes to you, an image. And then there's some stuff that you need to write about it.
Yeah.
You need to pull it from yeah. within.
And some, like, I've known, like, I've been now, this is 25 years away in different countries, you know, sometimes it was almost easier to write about things with distance and not just time, but also with geography, you know, with a couple of mountains and an ocean or two in between.
You know what? This is going to make me emotional, but I think that is why this book that I'm just beginning to work on it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm able to do it for exactly that reason, because I am an ocean away from, you know, I mean, it makes so much sense. I've thought about it in terms of time before, you know, like, I know I didn't write about my mom really for years and years, but also it, yeah, geography makes the difference. Maybe that's part of the readiness. It's brilliant.
Yeah, like, you know, the safe harbor, you know, whether you're looking across the other side of the river or the other side of an ocean, there's, you know, there's a lot going on in all those waves in between, whether it's coming in or going out.
Yeah, yeah, it's very true. Thank
well,
you.
Well, listen, I look forward to hearing the next collection and to discovering what actually comes out. Thank you so much. So much, Susan, for joining
Thank
me today
you.
On Eat the Storms. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been wonderful. Thank you so much. I've just, yeah, it's been wonderful. I was nervous, and you are beyond lovely. I adore you. Thank you so much for talking to me and for taking the time and thinking about me. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Right back at you. Ever since we met at the casino at our lunch, I always knew we were going to get on well, and we
yeah.
did. Thank you. So before we say goodbye today, I will leave you with one poem, this time from my debut pamphlet, Eat the Storms, which is published by Hedgehog Poetry Press back in 2020. I'm going to read this poem today because Susan read it so beautifully on her podcast, A Thousand Shades of Green, as part of her lineup for season one. Thank you so much once again to Susan and to all of my guests on today's show, Fred, Amanda and Ushin. This is called Tattered Brown Trousers. Father ate all the flowers in the back garden.
because he couldn't swallow the promise of happiness blooming within the home he couldn't find his root within. Father left all the flowers in the front garden, too proud for others to see him pulling from the soil everything he needed help with but had not been thought the words for. Father liked to laugh first when others lost, so no one could hear his own loss tearing at him like weeds, twisting behind the restraints he wore like those inside-out jumpers and tattered brown trousers he thought no one could see through. Father ate all the flowers and the shadows of the back garden and choked on a laugh that no one understood. Poetic peeps and gentle persons, in-betweeners and nonconformers, gender all and gender equals. We've reached the end of episode 2, season 8 of Eat the Storms, the poetry podcast. My name is Damien B. Donald. I've been your host and producer, and thank you so much for tuning in today, tomorrow, or whenever it is you dialed in, whether that's been on Spotify, Apple, Google, Breaker, Podbean, Player FM, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Castbox, Podcast Addicts, or iTunes. My guests on the podcast today have been Susan Richardson, Usheen Breen, Amanda Jane Shannon, and Fred Shrew. For details on all of my guests, just head on over to our website. That's www.eatthestorms.com. Click on the Listen to the Podcast section, and there you will find a blog post for every episode. This, as I said, is episode 2, season 8. And in that blog post, you will find photos, bios, and social media handles so you can find, follow, and favour all of our wonderful guests on the show today. Now, while you're favouring them, please feel free to sing about, to shout about, to post about this podcast. We're an international community, and here at Eat the Storms, we realise that the spotlight can only truly give off enough light and warmth when it is shared with others. So please do us a favour and share the hell out of this bloody poetic storm. The music on the podcast today is from purpleplanet.com, and the podcast itself is produced on Spotify for Podcasters, formerly known as Anchor. Until next time you tune your preferred podcast platform onto your preferred favourite storm, stay away from any real weather storms, stay away from all Debbie Downers, but most of all, stay bloody poetic!
Oh, thank you.